Hello, everyone. Marshall Poe here. I'm the founder of the New Books Network. First of all, I'd like to thank each and every one of you for listening to the network. We're glad you enjoy the interviews we produce. Thanks to your generous patronage, the NBN has grown very large. We've published 4,200 interviews, and we issue 100 new ones every month. You, our listeners, download about 25,000 interviews every day. Yes, that's right, 25,000. Now here's the rub. As we've grown, our costs have increased. So, in order to continue to do what we do, we need your support. Please consider making a donation to the NBN. We're a nonprofit, so your contribution will be tax deductible. Making a donation is easy to do. Just go to the NBN at newbooksnetwork.com and click the Support the NBN button. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy the following interview.
Welcome to New Books in Asian American Studies. I'm your host, Ian Shin. Today on our podcast, we have Professor Jason Oliver Chang speaking about his new book, Chino, Anti-Chinese Racism in Mexico, 1880 to 1940, recently published in 2017 by the University of Illinois Press. Jason is Assistant Professor of History and Asian American Studies at the University of Connecticut, where he specializes in Asian American history, comparative ethnic studies, and modern Mexico. Jason received his PhD from the Department of Ethnic Studies at UC Berkeley, as well as an MPA from UMass Amherst. Chino is a rich and compelling book. It traces the evolution of the Chinese in Mexico as disposable laborers, killable subjects, and pernicious defilers, and the uses of those images in cultivating a mestizo nationalism between 1880 and 1940. It's a book that will appeal not only to scholars and students of Asian American studies, but also Latin American history and critical race studies. I really enjoyed reading the book and speaking about it with Jason, and I hope that you enjoy our conversation. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Asian American Studies. I'm Ian Shin, the host of the channel. Today, my guest is Jason Oliver Chang, and we are talking with him about his new book, Chino, Anti-Chinese Racism in Mexico, 1880 to 1940, published in 2017 by the University of Illinois Press. Jason is Assistant Professor of History and Asian American Studies at the University of Connecticut, where he also serves as a faculty affiliate in the Institute of Latina, Latino, Caribbean, and Latin American Studies. Jason, welcome to the show.
Hello, Ian. Thanks. Yeah, it's great to be here.
Great to have you. Jason, I wondered if we could start the interview by having you tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, thanks. So, and I lived there all through growing up. But we often spend summers in Hawaii with my family, with my dad's side of the family. And so I had these two kind of places where I'm from that are really different. And by the time I left high school, I really wanted to go to get out of Indiana. Did a my bachelor's degree at Prescott College, this little hippie crunchy college in Arizona. But what was great about it was that I did 75% of my coursework in field studies. So that was the place where I fell in love with the U.S.-Mexico border and Latin American studies, Chicano studies. And, you know, from there, I kind of I didn't really know how I wanted to apply, you know, my understanding of the world. I felt like I needed more training, more. I wanted to dig deeper into questions of border militarization and immigration policy. And from there, I got a master's in public policy at UMass Amherst. And I focused on immigration enforcement and the intersection of incarceration and border militarization. So from there, I wanted to ask other questions that the policy world wasn't really interested in. I wanted to know more about the history of the borderlands, and a master's program wasn't going to be a good place for that. So I applied for PhD work in ethnic studies at UC Berkeley. And that was where I really, I I discovered the Chinese presence in Mexico. And I thought to myself, how can I, study this place, this region for so long and not know the presence of these folks here? And so I feel like the project kind of found me in a way. And as I was researching, the questions just kept on being met with, more questions. And so it was a really rich topic that really helped me to kind of think expansively about ethnic studies outside of the U.S. or what's portable, what's what are some of the core concerns that can ask of other places.
What was the reasoning behind choosing ethnic studies as your field of graduate study versus, say, history, in particular, given your interest in the history of borderlands?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. Well, when I was doing the master's in public policy, while I was looking at history books, it was the scholars in Chicano studies, the scholars in Asian American studies, who were asking the kinds of questions that I wanted to participate in that conversation. While there were numerous histories that I relied on from scholars from, without an ethnic studies affiliation, the approaches and the historiography from these from ethnic studies scholars really spoke to the kind of crisis I was seeing in the borderlands, and so it was like I saw a kind of intellectual genealogy that was that I wanted to learn from, and actually I'm just remembering now, I think there was also there was the book Color Lines and Borderlands. I think it's an edited volume about ethnic studies as an institution. I remember reading that in my master's program and thinking, the intellectual questions, the scholarly questions we ask are reflected in the institutions. And, the struggle for the institutional space of ethnic studies was also a part of creating the institutions to develop these intellectual projects. So I was really attracted to that too.
Right. Yeah. And I think one of the things that came through in the book, as we'll talk about later, is the way in which you so beautifully incorporate a range of different sources. And I think sometimes, speaking as a historian, I will say maybe the field can be a little bit, conservative, small c conservative, in terms of the kinds of sources that we engage in, and you do that so beautifully in Chino, and looking at photographs and paintings in addition to some of the more traditional documentary sources that historians like to use in crafting these kinds of histories. So I'd love to talk about that in a little bit with you in terms of your sources and your methodology. But perhaps we can start, because I think you've already led us into the background of ethnic studies as a crucial part of how you approach this project. I figured maybe we can just dive right into the introduction and to talk a little bit about some of the frameworks and interventions that you see yourself making. And you repeat many times in the book the idea that you are making an Asian Americanist critique in Mexican history. So I wonder if you could start us off by telling us a little bit about how you see that critique. What do you see as the value of an Asian Americanist intervention in this particular history?
Yeah, that's a great question. It really animated the research I was doing, and eventually when I got to the point where I was writing chapters and trying to make sense of the source material, I found my training in Asian American studies and ethnic studies to be to lead me to other kinds of questions about, say, like the relationship between the racial formations of indigenous folks in Mexico and how that intersected with anti-Chinismo, which, face value doesn't seem to be related. But because I come from an understanding of racial formations as being, intersubjective and linked at a structural level, I started exploring other questions like, how might these be related? What are the threads I can pull on to see, what sources might speak to that? And so, thinking about I came to a realization about the an Asian Americanist critique in one major revision of the manuscript, because there was an earlier version where I wrote it as an intervention primarily in Mexican history, and reading through it again at a moment when I was deeply reflective about the core concerns of the book, I came back to some of the core questions in Asian American studies, which is, what is the racial function of what is the political function of Orientalism? At what purpose does it serve? What are the intentions of Orientalist actors? What problems does it seek to resolve? And I think to me that was a useful framing for asking these sort of deeper questions about what racism looks like in another place. And Asian American studies has always been situated as a complication of a black-white binary in the U.S. And while that's that's not something to use as a cookie cutter to understand every other place in the world, but the understanding that that Asian racial difference fits within these other dominant frames of racial authority was like an aha moment for me, where I could kind of see through the sources and see another narrative, and see the relevance and the insight of this body of scholarship I had spent years studying took on new meaning for me.
Right. And I think all of our listeners will find the same too, because certainly speaking as somebody whose Asian Americanist training has very much focused on the U.S. context, this was a very exciting book for me to read, and I learned quite a lot from it. But I think as you talk about too, right, that this is in the introduction, this is part of a larger body of scholarship where people have looked at hemispheric Asian American or Asian Orientalism, and belongs to a larger and even sort of growing, recently growing body of literature on Asian American history in Cuba and in Mexico and other places outside, again, of the U.S., in Canada, certainly. Can you talk a little bit about how you see Asian American historiography in the context of these directions in which it's moving outside of the U.S. context, but still sticking to sort of an Asian American framework?
I think this, the hemispheric turn, if we could say that that's happening or that's a thing, or people are participating in it, I think it's linked to the other work that folks are doing in transnationalism. I'm thinking of other historians who are using source material in Asian languages, sort archives in Asia, to inform the U.S. context or to identify these new dimensions of transnational actors. That's an exciting direction, and and it really goes back to the foundations of diaspora in the field, and really enriches that study. And so I think, you know, the hemisphere is a part of that transnational field, and using those same kinds of frames of, you know, like I think of Ichiro Azuma's Between Two Empires, you know, like thinking about the incommensurability of two racial systems, you know, and how migrants are, you know, migrating peoples are, you know, implicated in both of those systems. And have to negotiate those, you know, the overlapping jurisdictions of these racial states, and so I think, you know, with that in mind, there's a need to, I mean, there's a pitfall of, you know, exporting a kind of a U.S.-centric understanding of racial politics to other places in order to accommodate these other environments, these other territories, these non-US spaces. And so I think, you know, for me, the struggle was to try to develop, you know, show a historical endemic process of, you know, of like racial hegemony, that what, you know, even though there is, you know, Orientalist discourses like circulated globally, it's super easy to find, you know, racial language in the archive, right? But the trick was to see, well, how were these words being deployed? What meanings were being imparted to them? What histories were they relying on in order to convey the authority that they, you know, that we read them with. So I think part of it was trying to distill, you know, work done in the U.S. and also kind of take a very measured and skeptical approach to reading sources outside of the U.S.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important, as you sort of put it, a kind of 1-2 punch, right? That there is recognizing the transnational turn in Asian American history, in Asian American studies, to sort of pair that with an in-depth, localized or national understanding of how these phenomena then play out within specific contexts, and you do that so richly in the case of Mexico, while still, you know, and we see glimpses of, again, transnational, you know, currents, foreign relations, that appear in the book, but that it's so sort of deeply focused on the Mexican story that we really are able to get that level of detail. So maybe with that, we can turn to the chapters themselves to really get a sense of the richness of this research. The first chapter in the book is The Politics of Chinese Immigration in the Era of Mexican National Colonization. And I wonder if you can start us off by talking about, for those listeners who, again, maybe like me, approach Asian American history or Asian American studies from more of a U.S.-based context. You know, the book begins in the late 19th century, around 1870s, 1880s. What is the picture that people should have in terms of the background for Chinese immigration to Mexico in the late 19th century? And for example, how do we begin to start thinking about it in the context of what you call Mexico's quote-unquote Indian problem? So how are those things related in the late 19th century?
Yeah. So this period, where the Chinese are entering in greater numbers than they have before in Mexico, happens after a long period of civil war, foreign intervention in Mexico, enormous instability. They lost the war with the U.S., lost half of the country, their northern territories. So Mexico as a republic, as a political project has been just very unstable and not able to participate or, you know, kind of organize itself to be a part of what, you know, what other nations were aspiring to with, you know, modernization. This all changes in the 1870s, 1880s, with the rise of Porfirio Diaz, who's a dictator, or it was a general who becomes an authoritarian leader in Mexico, and for the first time provides some political stability for an aggressive campaign for modernization. And whereas, you know, so Mexico's history actually, you know, is very intimately tied with the rise of globalization. The Spanish Empire's, New Spain colony was the center of global commerce, bringing in trade from Philippines and East Asia, and then circulating that with commerce from Europe and across the Atlantic. And there has always been an intellectual and political assertion that Mexico was a part of this central part of globalization. And during this period, there was this time in the 1870s, 1880s, there was this time where they thought, well, we're going to modernize and reestablish our position as a, you know, the crossroads of global commerce. But they needed to do some serious development. They needed railroads. They thought about digging a canal across the isthmus. They wanted to develop their ports, and they knew that they had supplied the world's empires with silver for the last several hundred years. They knew they had the mineral wealth, the natural resources to be, you know, a developed, strong country. They rationalized this deficiency by saying, well, we simply don't have enough white people. We have too many Indians. They don't know how to modernize. They're unreliable. And that's what explains why Mexico is not higher up on the ladder of development. And so, you know, Mexican officials and politicians looked around the world, looked around at other colonies around the world, and said, well, other places are developing very quickly developing capitalist industrial economies. And they saw how people were using coolies, how people were using enslaved Africans, right? So there were a number of, they looked at the colonial world as a kind of laboratory for development schemes. And the Chinese were a second or third choice. They tried recruiting many different ethnic groups from Europe. They saw some benefits of incorporating other African laborers. But one of the things that defined the attractiveness of Chinese workers for industrialists, for policymakers in Mexico at this time, was that the Chinese could be disposable, that contracted laborers could be hired for work and then sent back or let go. Whatever happened after the job was not important to them, because they considered them to be disposable.
And this is where the term motores de sangre come in, right? So can you maybe say a little bit about, because that term, we're now verging into chapter two territory, but I hadn't been familiar with that term. So can you talk a little bit about what motores de sangre means and what work it does in the context of Mexican history during this period?
Yeah. So Motores de Sangre is Spanish for, I mean, the direct translation is like blood engine. And that's what the 19th century agronomists and other economists, other industrial thinkers consider for a label for draft animals, right? So these were mechanisms of force that could be directed and employed for different kinds of jobs, whether it be plowing fields, digging ditches. These were the engines of labor, basically. And so this was an attractive idea because as Mexican officials were planning out how to get railroads built, these were simply discrete labor inputs they did not have to consider or they didn't think they had to consider other social implications or provide for their well-being in any other fashion. These were simply, a means to building infrastructure. And this was a successful idea, in part because the U.S. was doing the exact opposite at the time. Had the United States not passed the Chinese Exclusion Act in the 1880s, it's unclear whether there would have been significant Chinese labor for the projects that they wanted. The U.S. would have been a much more attractive place to go to. So by closing the doors to Chinese migration, to legitimate, authorized, Chinese migration in 1882, it fueled the demand for labor in Mexico. This is a time when Mexico is passing colonization laws, national colonization laws, where they would identify territories, spaces in the Republic, territories that needed that were essential to certain infrastructure, to linking different areas from production to export, and they would basically accept bids from companies, from individuals, and contract out development to these other companies, and many of them would identify Chinese labor as a part of the contract.
Right, and the way that you just talked about how Motores de Sangre appear to officials as, sort of a form of labor where they don't need to worry about their sort of other social implications. One of the things that I love about how you write the book is while there is a very strong focus on the sort of political and intellectual history of anti-Chinese racism, you also pay attention to the ways in which they strike out on their own and live their own lives. So in chapter two, you write about how they, and I'm quoting you here, defy dominant characterizations as disinterested sojourners or motores de sangre by forming relationships with indigenous women in Sonora in particular. So I wondered if you could, against this sort of trope of the motor de sangre, I guess, in singular form, against that trope, how do Chinese migrants during this period, I guess this would be during the Porfiriato, how did they begin to establish their own agency and their lives, which I think you sort of point to in various parts of the book?
Yeah. This was a difficult area to research, to find their voices and interpret their actions. Sometimes as historians, we only have traces of the choices that they made by virtue of certain kinds of documentation, and so it's very difficult to find the ways that the social lives of these individuals But you know, to me, it became important to spell these to try to address this question because of the nature of the racial project at hand. One of the things that I noticed about this was that these were elite notions of Chinese racial difference, right? These were urban Mexico City, often criollo, who are white Mexicans, who they're the power elite, right? They're industrialists. And while those ideologies and discourses shaped the demand and the recruitment of these individuals, it didn't actually translate into, say, like a popular understanding of who the Chinese were on the ground in these places. You know, so so like when the Chinese would go and work on railroads, and then they would they'd finish a section, or they would the project would be over, they would go and look for other work find other places to settle. The people around them didn't think of them as motores de sangre, right? So some kind of thought, there was a notion of labor competition in some respects, but also, at this time, before the revolution, most peasants were excluded from citizenship, from active and real, any real kind of political participation. So the notion that Mexican people were already had a national identity that kept them, that created distance from the Chinese, that I didn't really see that in the sources, right? So so I think while on the one hand there is this racial project of defining the Chinese as motores de sangre, that brings them there, but it doesn't ultimately shape how they're living their lives. And indeed, because of the exploitative nature of their work and the remoteness of the places where they were, the people they ended up encountering, one, had a contentious relationship with being Mexican, and two, may have done similar work in the past, and so maybe saw them as being more like them than different. Seeing as a majority of the men were, or majority of the migrants were men, the intimacy with indigenous women was going to happen, and that coincided with a pretty intense anti-Indian politics in the places where they were located.
Yeah, I think it's important to emphasize to folks who are listening that, I mean, that is one of the central arguments of your book, where you talk about the fact that oftentimes interpretations of this period stress or assume almost a preexistence of a mestizo national identity, right? And that's what explains anti-Chinese racism. But in fact, you show in such detail that mestizo nationalism actually grows up in conjunction with or because of anti-Chinese racism, that's the sort of instrument through which that mestizo national identity takes shape after the revolution.
Right.
Maybe leading us to that is my next question, which is, by the end of chapter two, I think as we go into chapter three, you see the emergence of this idea of self-colonization. And colonization is a word that you've already used. Particular to this idea of self-colonization is, and again, I'm quoting you here, the Mexican peasant was beginning to be considered as an agent of modernization, which of course is different from the way that, as you've talked about before, peasants were seen earlier. Right. So how did this self-colonization movement and policy come about during this period?
Yeah. So this was, there, in this phase of modernization, you know, there were many officials who were frustrated by the lack of progress, and they wanted to see, you know, things moving in a different direction. And so there essentially became what I saw as two camps of political elites. One were kind of like technocratic industrialists that saw the Chinese as the answer and need for expansion of recruitment of Chinese workers. And then another that were nativists who saw, well, you know, that the Indians may have been poor agents of modernization in the past, but if we take them as a pedagogical subject that can be trained and disciplined and brought into and modernized, you know, like that would be, then if we modernize the Indians themselves, then we will be in a place where industrialization will just come naturally. And so there was, you know, so at the center of both of these ideas is the racial, you know, the racial state, right? What is, you know, the Mexican state's vision of modernization is through the enactment of these racial projects. And so while, you know, the Indian problem was that the Indian problem in Mexico, as it was discussed at the time, was that there were too many folks who weren't reliable workers, right? And that many of them did not see each other as having anything in common. You know, there were hundreds of linguistic ethnic groups and you know, completely different ethnic identities and different regions, right? So the idea that that Sari in Sonora would have anything in common with Juchitán in the South would, you know, it is assuming a lot. But nevertheless, you know, in elite politics, they thought that Indians were all the same. And so, you know, uniting them in a project of modernization was also, you know, an immense, you know, national, an immense project of both nation building and state building. And so the when the Chinese are thought of as a solution to that problem, it really brings together the core concerns, the core crises of the Mexican state, the problem of legitimacy, the coherence of the republic, the meaning of sovereignty, the relationship of contentious sovereignty between indigenous republics and the Mexican state. And because the Chinese were thought of as a solution to this, the meaning of their racial difference went right to the heart of these crises and continued to animate them.
And when we see that begin to resolve itself in violent ways, which is the subject of Chapter 3, Violent Imaginaries and the Beginnings of a New State, you look at mass killings, tactical assassinations, and other kinds of violent rituals against the Chinese in the 19-teens, and you introduce the term grotesque assemblies. I wondered if you could sort of explain to our listeners, you know, sort of how you think about this concept of a grotesque assembly.
Okay. So this chapter, you know, my main goal with this chapter was to dispel the mythology that that the Chinese were despised and killed because they were perceived as being outside of the Mestizo Nation, mm-hmm. right? And this was, to me, that everything in the source material was showing me that, one, no one was claiming to be mestizo, and two, that there were all these other factors that were much more compelling, and that that actually tied in a lot of the historical discontent and aggression, both between Indians and the state, and between Indians and other Mexicans, and so. In thinking about those relationships, I first was able to identify the ways that anti-Chinese violence during the revolution itself, from like 1910 to 1920, basically, was organized primarily by anti-Porfirian sentiment. Right, many people saw the Chinese as this kind of residue of the old regime, and that through killing the Chinese, through getting rid of Chinatowns in their communities wherever they found them, that was one way of envisioning a new Mexico, right? Because they were such a visible part of the Porfirian era, and they were a part of almost every modernization project, and so wherever they were. Wherever they were seen, as that this was a sign that of the Porfirian government, and in looking at these kinds of violence, I began to read this other literature about like homicidal ideation, why do people imagine killing other people, what kind of problem does that violence seek to resolve? And in kind of playing around with these ideas and seeing how they related, if they stuck, if they were relevant, it made me think about the social significance of violence as a way that that in which people participate in violence. By imagining something else, by imagining some future that does not yet exist, and that as I was reading this literature, reading the source material, I began to think along the lines of like imagined communities, right, and that across Mexico, people that had very little in common beforehand were cooperating, working together in the expulsion of Chinese from their towns, or rounding up Chinese, murdering them in the streets, that this was a form of imagined community. It didn't seem appropriate to use that in this fashion, and so I was thinking of grotesque assembly as a way to get at this terrible expression of collectivity, but nevertheless recognizing its social significance in the context of revolution and the disruption of ethnic boundaries, racial boundaries that were there for decades, if not more. And because I wanted to give that historical moment its the meaning and the significance that it deserves, while also recognizing that these were terrible events.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note too, or what I found really insightful was, aside from the sort of strong symbolic significance of attacking the Chinese, and I love the way that you sort of write about this in a quote where you say that envisioning anti-Chinese violence was a social experience. When eyes mm-hmm. were transfixed on the spectacle of anti-Chinese violence, men and women stood shoulder to shoulder, class divisions evaporated, and inter-ethnic tensions dissolved. Right? We really get a sense of the sort of symbolic significance of that. I think the other insight that I found from this chapter is, and at first I was kind of struggling with your use of the word assassination, but it made much more sense when I understood it as also a strategic intervention, that there was a real sort of economic advantage to attacking, for example, Chinese businesses whom they understood to be in cahoots with the Porfirian elites, for example, that was sort of taking resources away from that armed struggle that they were engaged in. The other question that I have for you about this chapter, I think, goes back to the homicidal ideation. Was that the literature that sounds, by the way, like a really difficult literature to get through?
It's true. I mean, psychology and other disciplines have explored this.
Yeah.
Criminology. Go ahead.
Well, so I was going to ask whether there is a distinction between the fact that violence happens or homicidal violence happens and the intensity of that violence, right? Because I was reading, through some of the examples you provided, and you write about how many Chinese residents suffer really grisly deaths, being dragged into the street, butchered with knives and butchered with hatchets. So is there a difference between, just sort of being anti-China? How can we explain essentially the intensity of that violence?
Yeah.
And how does that tell us about the depth of the nationalist sentiments that people are experiencing during this time?
Mm-hmm. Yes. The techniques of violence deployed in the revolution are not new in Mexico. This level of brutality has been practiced on the indigenous population since the founding of the republic in the early 19th century. And even the Spanish wars against against rebellious Indian republics before that, for the centuries prior to that. Violence was a part of these communities, and largely because of state-driven projects of employing one group against another, legitimizing one group's claims over another group's claims, deploying violence was one way of gaining legitimacy in a world where the state might not recognize your rights at all. I didn't develop that argument very well in this book, but there's a lot of literature about the Indian Wars in Mexico and the level of brutality practiced. And so I think, while on the one hand we kind of treat the revolution as a kind of modern battlefield, it's the violence being deployed there is very old. And in this case here, we see it deployed with, against, different subjects. And I think, it's a part of claiming authority. It's a part of expressing discontent with, institutions that have denied the existence and the participation of the majority of the republic for the last 100 years.
Right. I'd love to talk more about that, but I think we better move on to the fourth chapter, because that'll help us progress to the rest of the story. And chapter four, which is Abajo los Chinos, the political invention of mestizo nationalism, is really about the institutionalization of the racial scripts that are that come out of these grotesque assemblies you write about in chapter three. And, you know, there's so much in here, yeah. and I want to talk about all of it with you, especially all these civic societies that pressure local, state, and federal officials. Mm. But I think what I want to ask you about is actually about gender and sexuality, because you talk about how yeah. central of a role yeah. it is in the antigenismo that begins to get institutionalized in post-revolutionary Mexico. So what is the significance of female biological and social reproduction during this period? And in particular, how do mm-hmm. we also understand that in contrast to the chineras, right? So you write about Mexican women who marry Chinese men and they're right. ashamed. So again, it seems like there is sort of this tension of an emphasis on female biological and social reproduction, but you also see Mexican women who have married Chinese men. So obviously not everybody buys into this ideology. So can you talk a little bit about gender and sexuality in chapter four?
Yeah, yeah. This was one of the chapters that I probably revised the most because trying to mark this transition from the streets to, violence, And then the transformation from that to a meeting hall, to institutions, to the development of organizations that have like racist letterhead, that's a really intense transformation. And noting, as I was going through the records of different state legislatures in Mexico and seeing when and where anti-chinistas showed up, I was surprised to see the extent to which Mexican women were all across the country, at legislatures, campaigning for the adoption of this three-point plan, the ending of Chinese migration, rejection of the Chinese-Mexican Treaty, which was established in 1899, and the prevention of miscegenation between Chinese men and Mexican women. And these were Mexican women who were out there arguing and trying to convince legislatures in different states to adopt these measures, and in thinking about that, I was trying to put this political behavior in the context of a new republic, right? The government had been completely destroyed. The state was completely, demolished. And a new constitution was written in 1917. And this was a completely different government with new ideals and new rationales for sovereignty. The 1917 constitution creates for the first time in any constitution the basis of sovereignty is on the social rights of its residents. That meant the protection of the indigenous population. And so at this time, we also see the invention of new forms of belonging, new practices of citizenship. And there's no set plan for what works, what's legitimate, who's using authority in a valid way. These were all questions that were in flux, and so I look at the campaigns as being a part of this experiment in post-revolutionary citizenship, and so. Women were in this unique position where the state was seeking legitimacy and authority, and women were also seeking to be recognized and to have authority as well. the racial question of the Chinese provided both parties with a rationale for policy reform, for action, and it was enormously popular. It was really popular because it didn't disrupt any of the other power dynamics, right? It didn't challenge the capitalist nature of the revolutionary of the inheritors of the revolution. It didn't challenge male authority, and it was something that a lot of Mexicans from different corners of the country could agree on. And so when it came time for them to argue for their Mexicanness, they were able to use their position as women to argue for this kind of what we would think of as this kind of Foucauldian discourse of reproduction, of the biopolitics of biological reproduction, that they were this linchpin to the future nation, right? That the nation would only be remade through women. On the one hand, I want to recognize that they were political agents, right? On the other hand, I want to recognize that they're operating within a patriarchal world, and so they were as contextualized by the choices granted to them, and the possibilities of violence on the other side. So in kind of trying to feel out the women's participation in these racist campaigns, it also made me think about chinetas too, and how Mexican national identity wasn't hegemonic at this time, right? It didn't reach down into every community. Marrying a Chinese man often meant that you lost your Mexican nationality, and you became Chinese by virtue of marrying this foreign-born individual. So the fact that many women gave that up shows that perhaps they didn't feel like losing Mexican nationality was that big of a loss, right? To me, these were all signals that that state authority and legitimacy were still up for grabs, and that nothing except violence was hegemonic at this time.
Yeah, I think it's one of the really nice parts of the book that you show the contingencies with which this ideology, even as it's growing in popularity, is still in flux. And I think one of the other points in this chapter that I was very curious about, although I don't think I have time to talk about it today, is the 1928 failed proposal for a constitutional amendment to restrict Chinese immigration. And you talk, just very briefly about some of the structural, economic and political repercussions of adopting an anti-Chinese platform that actually helps to restrain that movement for a constitutional amendment, right? And so I think what's so interesting about this chapter is how it's sort of, two steps forward and one step back for the anti-Chinistas, as they're sort of gathering in meeting halls. But let's maybe now that we're on the cusp of the 1930s, I'd love to talk to you about Chapter 5 and the conclusion. Chapter 5, Forging a Racial Contract, where you sort of bring this home in terms of, as you put it, the growing racial competency of the state, right? That we really begin to see this sort of coalesce into not just violence and displacement, which continues to happen, but also broad policy measures like the 1930 census, like the federal labor reform, and like the creation of the National Registry of Foreigners. So can you tell us how the story, where do you see the story ending? Where does anti-Chinismo get us ultimately by the 1930s in Mexico?
Yeah, that's great questions. Yeah, so if the previous chapter was about how anti-Chinismo eventually became a part of many grassroots organizations across the country, and eventually became a part of the dominant political party, the Partido Nacional Revolucionario. Then this last chapter, the chapter five, is about how anti-Chinismo went from Mexico City outward, and began to structure different kinds of policies, different rationales for state making. This is the chapter too where I really struggled with how to write about the relationship between anti-Indian sentiment on the one hand and anti-Chinismo on the other. And this was where I kind of applied the lessons from the last chapter to say, well, okay, anti-Chinismo might have been the most successful grassroots organization at the time, and they were able to argue for their legitimacy on the basis of the new constitution more effectively than anyone else at the time was arguing for a common good, right? No, other contenders for power were arguing for their veteran status as leaders of the revolution or as industrialists, that these were political bosses that were trying to maintain power. Whereas anti-Chinistas, they were the ones who were actually only interested in the public good, right? So their ability to use that discourse and to identify with these core assertions of the revolutionary state was sort of unmatched. No one else was really talking in these ways. And so this was, I try to capture this in looking at the 1929 presidential election, this is between a state endorsed candidate and then another really famous Mexican actor. His name is Jose Vasconcelos, who's often attributed with this the popularity of mestizo nationalism at this time, And while Vasconcelos loses, right? He's also it's not really clear how fair the election was, or that it most certainly didn't represent the whole republic. But nevertheless, he lost on this platform of national evolution. But what won the discourse that the PNR used in the victory was that while Vasconcelos might have been about mestizaje, this was an unstructured and undisciplined, romantic vision of mestizaje. Whereas the PNR was going to organize mestizaje, race mixing, miscegenation, as a state building, nation building project. And this has been the goal of anti-Chinistas since the 1920s, since the beginning of the decade. So when this argument comes around, anti-Chinistas are very well positioned to act on this, become policy leaders, become leaders in Congress, and very effectively are able to turn policy areas from diverse as nationality and public health, labor politics, all of these things into a national platform of like a policy platform for the party, and so this was a new way of kind of mobilizing a national identity that didn't previously exist.
There's so much in the book, and I really wish we had more time to talk about it. You know, I really wanted to ask you about the role of eugenics, which also comes in this chapter, yeah. But also, you know, some of the glimpses of, again, resistance, you know, with some of the folks who did risk their lives to save their Chinese neighbors, whether there's sort of a pro-Chinista kind of movement that we can also talk about. But it's a really rich book about racialized statecraft that I hope our listeners will dig into on their own. We've taken up so much of your time, but I wonder, before we finish the interview, I wondered if you could tell us what you're working on now. What is your current project, and when perhaps when can we look forward to seeing your next piece of work?
Oh yeah. So actually, my most current project right now was building some cabinets. That's been carpentry has been a nice reprieve, a sort of post-Chino way of getting back my life. But in terms of the research, what I've been really digging into lately has been a look at mariners, at Chinese, at Asian sailors. And this occurred to me in doing some of the research for Chino, where I would find a lot of anxiety in Mexico about sailors, about Asian sailors, and their mobility, but then also that, you know, occasionally Mexican industrialists were interested in building their own steamship companies, and that they would possibly need Chinese or Asian sailors to crew the boats. And so as I started thinking about this, I was realizing that, you know, much of Asian American history is driven by the politics of the people who got off of the boats. You know, our field is, you know, necessarily structured by the denied belonging of these individuals. But there were also thousands of other people who did not get off the boats, but which made these voyages possible. And so thinking about that kind of blind spot in the field really gave me pause to think about, well, what are the other political, you know, aspirations of these people that don't get engaged in this narrative of denied belonging? These sailors weren't interested in acquiring U.S. citizenship, but nevertheless were a part of the U.S. merchant fleet, were a part of the steamship companies. And indeed, you know, deeper examination, we see that there's, you know, a dependency upon these Asian sailors. So I started looking into maritime history and thinking about the maritime traditions in Asia and their relationships with empire, and how that picture came to inform how they encountered the United States in the 19th century.
That's fascinating. And I love the way you're positioning that and framing that as a project about the people who don't get off the boat.
Right, yeah.
I think maybe there's a TV show down the line you can make that's fresh on the boat rather than fresh off the boat. But with that That's terrible right. with that terrible That's joke, right. I want to thank you for being on the show today, Jason. It was a really pleasure to talk to you about Chino, about your new book, and I really enjoyed having a chance to read it. So thank you again.
Oh, Ian, it's my pleasure, and you know, I love this podcast, and it's been really awesome to hear your thoughts on the book, and so thank you for that too.
Take care. That was my conversation with Jason Oliver Chang, speaking about his new book, Chino: Anti-Chinese Racism in Mexico, 1880 to 1940, published in 2017 by the University of Illinois Press. This is New Books in Asian American Studies, and I'm your host, Ian Shin. Thanks for listening.